Hello, you're listening to Me and Paranormal You with your host, Ryan Singer. Because it's more fun to believe.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to another experience of Me and Paranormal You. This is a first. Well, it's a first in the Zoom era, for sure, in the remote era for me. But we're going to do, I think we're calling it the triangle table. I've got Daniel Noah, I've got Jim Perry, both former guests, friends of the program. Can we say friends of the program? We can say very deep, close, blood brothers of the program. Oh, did I go too far with that? So we've got a laundry list of things that we want to talk about today. I already know for a fact that we're not going to get to all of them. Just due to the nature of how things are going to play out here. And all of them are exciting to think about the discussions that may be happening. So thanks for coming on today, guys.
You're welcome.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't know what caught me by surprise. That
yeah.
We
yeah.
Talking to each other.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, oh wait, Ryan's not just talking; he's actually engaging in conversation,
addressing the audience, and yeah. Oh, I see my role in this conversation is introducing constant chaos into the structure that you've planned.
Okay, so you will be the trickster today.
That's right.
Jim will be the bedrock, a foundation of sanity.
As he always is.
And I'll be the ingenue. Like what? what's happening? Jim will be like, let me tell you what's happening. And then Daniel will be like, oh, here's another thing. And I'll be like, what? And then Jim will be like, this is what's happening.
Is the ingenue constantly astounded by what's happening?
Yeah, I think I'm probably using that word wrong. But
you'll be receiving an email.
Okay, this is off to a good start.
Yes.
I think what we can kick off with first is we were talking about this a little bit in multiple different conversations we've had, but I want to start with the human brain, and it's an instrument. And now, is it a trustworthy instrument? And because everything that we experience, and this is very timely because this book that I'm like trudging through, even though I really enjoy it, is the last thing I read about it is in it was, you know, how all of our senses process reality, right? And our reality is constructed literally by our brains, and that there is a universe inside every single person, and because that's where the universe comes from, launching from the senses that we at least believe we have access to interpret our experiences. Now, So our brain literally is creating our entire universe in that sense. So is it trustworthy? And when we get, especially when we get into paranormal experiences and experiences that not everyone seems to be having, the question is like, you know, the simple question, I guess, is like, well, why me, man? You know, or like, or why not everybody else? And maybe we can get into that a little bit as well. But Daniel, I'd like you to take the lead on this one a little bit, because this is a subject you offered up initially when we were chatting beforehand, just like some initial thoughts on the trustworthiness of the brain as the instrument.
Yeah. What's the name of the book?
Oh, it's, The Death of Forever by Daryl Rainey, who was a scientist who's no longer with us. But
got it. It's funny because you used both of you received an email from me recently that had very similar language in it. I thought you were punking me about calling my email a book you were reading. is the brain no. I don't think it is at all. I think where I'm coming to stand on this question is that the brains that we have in our head are instruments to interpret the formless reality around us, the maelstrom of chaos that actually exists, that we are not equipped to process or handle in any way, shape, or form, because we're extremely unevolved beings. And force of design or architecture or benevolence or malevolence, I don't know, that we've all been given these little baby computers in our heads that have 5 input channels on them, that the purpose of which is to introduce a structure that we can agree upon so that we can communicate and talk and see each other and stop at a stop sign and put money in a bank account but none of it's actually real. It is, but it also isn't. And I think, you know, to John Keel's point, I've seen him variously attribute the statistic differently, but you know, that somewhere between, you know, 15 and 30% of the human population has varying access to additional senses that might allow us to just briefly glimpse or brush or graze the actual chaotic reality that's around us all the time. And you know, those people are variously called shamans or schizophrenics or clairvoyants or mediums or artists, which I'm coming, you know, to believe is the, you know, this is not an original idea, but that, you know, artists really do perform the role of the shaman in our society. And you know, the role of the shaman is to walk into the dark cave and confront chaos and insanity and be willing to come back out and discuss it or portray it in some small way. And sometimes those people are revered and sometimes they're considered pariahs, you know, heretics. I think the brain is lying to us at all times. And it's this instrument of deceit that's put into our heads. But I also think that it's full potential to be unlocked, that it would be a very trustworthy instrument. It's just that it's like it's a computer that they said, you know, has you're only able to access a tiny percentage of its computing power, and so as such, it's not portraying its data accurately.
That's interesting, and I'm glad you brought up the email. I wasn't sure if you wanted me referencing that or not.
Yeah, maybe not too much.
yeah. So
we can touch on some points of the content, but not the context.
Well, I'll touch on the point you just mentioned.
Yeah. Okay.
Definitely not punking you, but it was like really, you know, it was such great synchronicity, because I think it was the night. It was the next night, actually, after I read the email, that I was reading this in the book. It's really, I mean, I'm done. I'm over the whole idea of like, you believe this? Like, yeah. I'm just kind of now grooving into, yeah, well, this is the way it goes. This is the way it happens. Mm. It's like things happen and unfold as they should. And of course it happened this way, because this is when I needed to read that, and this is when I needed to read this.
Right.
And so, Jim,
and how great does that feel when you're in the groove in that space?
I feel like I think it's The Prophet's Way by Robert Hartman, which is this book I've read twice. I forgot I read it the first time, and then read it like maybe 15 or whatever years later, and I was like, this seems really familiar. It's this really great book, and it talks about synchronicities being signposts that you're on the right path, and that you're kind of doing what you're, you know, supposed to be doing, essentially. You know, it's not saying that they are, you know, maybe mile markers on your destiny necessarily, but it shows you that you're clicking, right?
Right.
And so that's why ever since I heard that, I really leaned into it, and because it resonated with me. So when synchronicities keep popping up, that's when I'm like, that they're like encouraging. It's like, it's almost like when you're running a marathon and someone's there with a cup of sugar water, right, cheering you on. Like maybe a loved one shows up unexpectedly, like, hey, keep going, you can do it. That's to me what synchronicities are.
Right.
You know, they're holding a little sign for you that says, keep going, don't quit.
Well, I think once you experience all of that, which is beautiful, but also sometimes terrifying, when you don't have that presence in your life anymore, and you've had an incredible string of synchronicities, it sucks. It sucks to not have that in your life, you know? And I have a lot of listeners that'll email me questions, or especially when I have, you know, sort of like Tim on the program, you know, they'll ask us, you know, what's going on? The sync's dropped off. The wonder is gone. I'm not seeing UFOs anymore. You know, those bumps in the night, I'm not experiencing. What is happening? Is it something I'm doing? And I truly believe it's sort of a conversation. And going back to this idea of the mind's, you know, the part it's playing in all of this, you know, it's very theatrical, this whole dance that we're in, seemingly with reality. It is providing a space that we're able to translate and communicate essentially what is a version of consensus reality, right? And within that, it does hold potential for deeper conversations. And I think that's what it is. The brain acts as a moderator for frequent various conversation types. And it just so happens we, you know, based on sort of physical survival of these meat bodies, right? We're conditioned, we're preconditioned to engage mostly in a very physical form of communication. And that's these things that are feeding, you know, our lusts, our desires, our wants, our needs in a physical consensus reality scape. Now, that's not to discount, you know, sort of even within the ancient world, our ability to incorporate some form of spirituality or a higher relationship. But let's be honest, that was also based off of a physical action that folks were taking to enter into those communicable spaces. As in, these were mushrooms, these were psychedelics, these were physical things that you could do to your body. Maybe this was meditation, maybe this was controlling a breath, maybe this was entering into a bigger cosmic headspace by way of combat, right? That the ancients found to go, okay, we get it. We're in communication with something physical here because of our physical mindscapes, but there's something else there. And here are some ways we can get there. And it's from elevating or almost sometimes over maxing our physical capabilities to bust the door through the veil into something else. And so I do think it's an evolving conversation. And I think that folks like us who have really had sort of the pleasure to be able to enter into these highly charged synchronistic spaces where we're exploring the wonderment of the world, we're privileged in a sense to be able to do that in some ways. And I think that when that leaves us, it's like some friend is leaving us. It's like some part of us, it's like some doorway has closed, and we can feel it on the physical plane just as much as we feel in the mental plane.
It's like, it's such a wild ride to use the brain to try to figure out the brain. And I love it. And then it's like also this thing where the longer I do it, the more I feel detached from being able to understand absolutely anything. And which I'm not going to lie, part of me really enjoys that sensation. But I guess what I'm curious about is, and Daniel, you talk about like us, like the evolution, like if we're talking about the spectrum of evolution here, now we're not evolved enough to be using something that we've been given, right? And I don't want it to be as simple as, well, why would we be given this if we can't use it? I think that's an unanswerable question potentially, but if the brain is not reliable and everything is real and simultaneously unreal, which I'm totally behind that idea. doesn't that apply to absolutely everything? The things that seem unreal to many people, like let's say Bigfoot, ghosts, isn't that just as unreal to the person who's experienced it as everything else in that sense? Does it, is this making any sense? It's almost like a double layered unreal.
No, 100%. In fact, Jim and I were just talking about this on the phone the other day, that I was talking about the weekend that Ariel and I had that was just rife with strangeness, and to the point where it just became the air we were breathing for a week, and it became almost normal, a wash of strange things, and little and big both. And it got me to thinking about who are we to say what is part of the known world and part of the unknown world? Like, where is that line? Who gets to decide? If there, you know, if I'm a guy who, for some strange reason, I never learned about elephants, and I see an elephant, I'm going to say that's a monster, right? For example. But then others would say, no, that's just an elephant. That's, you know, that's in, it's here in this book, and we've analyzed its biology, and that's part of the natural world, right? So, you know, when I'm a city boy, I grew up in Chicago, and then I lived in New York, you know, I lived in LA. I've only ever lived on pavement. So when I leave pavement, I'm off my game. Like, I don't know what weird sounds and sensory experiences are normal and not normal. They're all unknowns to me. So it's like being in a paranormal world. But my girlfriend, who grew up on a farm, is like, bro, that's a woodpecker, you know? And so, but, so to, I mean, to your point, I don't even remember what your question was anymore, but you know, what, yeah, where is that boundary? Where does it live? And I think, you know, the other thing that I was thinking of while you were teeing up your question was sort of getting back to the dependability of the brain is, and you're saying, like, why were we given these tools and then not allowed to use them entirely, like, why? What's that system? Who said that? What's the logic behind that? And I think the best answer that I can come up with to that question at this moment in time is that it's like we're sort of in a meritocracy. I think that it's like if there is someone who's got their finger on a knob, a little equalizer controlling, you know, how much of our brains we can use, they're waiting for us to, just like I do with my daughter, who's like, if, you know, if you want more responsibility, you've got to show that you can handle the responsibility I've given you. They're waiting for us to evolve a little bit, and then they'll toggle up how much input we can handle. And I don't think we're doing too well, by the way. You know, I don't think we're going to get granted that access, because we haven't demonstrated that we can handle the access that we've been given. We're destroying our planet, we're destroying our home, we're killing each other, we're at each other's throats all the time. So, you know, if my daughter and her friends were behaving that way and asked for more independence, I would say, no, you're gonna kill yourselves. And so, like children, we're behaving very badly. And so I don't expect that we will evolve. Honestly, I think we'll perish before that ever happens. And
wow, I mean, it's
welcome to Mr. Roger Seabrood.
welcome to the end times. This is your host, Ryan. And why are you even listening? To that point, though, it is these innate desires that I have. Like, for example, this is something very basic. When I see a Toyota 4Runner driving on the roads, I am drawn to it. Aesthetically, there is just no more beautiful of a vehicle, in my opinion. I'm not a car guy, but when I see a Toyota 4Runner, I'm like, I want a 4Runner. I could sleep in that. Like, I could live in that, right? And it gets like 19 miles a gallon on the highway. It's like, it is awful. Right. And I look at 4Runners on the internet for sale, And it's like, why would I ever buy a Toyota 4Runner? It's like one of the worst cars for the environment. Did we just forget about that? You know, remember when climate change became a thing, and then like all SUVs were kind of shamed. Like, you can't buy an SUV. You got to buy a car that's good. And then after about 5 years, everybody was like, oh, we're back to SUVs now. Aren't they the best? It's like everyone just kind of forgot, right? It seems like. So to that point, I think when it comes to perish or evolve, I think the needle definitely is towards the perish side, if I had to guess. But physical, is perishment a word or perishing? I suppose is a lot different than the perishing of consciousness, right?
Right.
And if the brain is nothing but a capsule, or at least an anchor point, like a dock station for consciousness potentially, you know, what does that mean about consciousness? I mean, do you have thoughts on that? Do you have thoughts on consciousness, Jim?
Yeah, I mean, well, some will say that, you know, that consciousness part of the brain or ourselves never even really lives in the brain and never really lives in us. And that if we can think of consciousness sort of outside of our own body and the environment, and one that is filtered through the brain, in fact, our consciousness may in fact live outside there with all of it, all swimming together, right? And it's only our receivers that sort of have our own brand name, our serial number, right? That picks up that signal of our bit of consciousness that actually lives out here somewhere. And could that explain our ability for a lot of different psychic, psychic abilities? I don't know, maybe. I mean, I think that, like, we're not talking about some light material here. And I think listeners will appreciate that, in that we're really talking about the meaning of life.
That's
at the end of the day, you know, that's it, right? That's it. So, who's to say, but, you know, one has to wonder if such brilliant machinations have been orchestrated to develop what we are experiencing in the beauty of reality and what could be beyond. What if this isn't all to some sort of grand plan? And what if our lives are meant to be sort of filled with pain? If our experience is meant to be one that is sort of dragged through the mud until we elevate on a different space and into a different space, right? In the sense that, yeah, maybe humanity is just doomed for death. You know, death of our physical bodies, of our physical space, of the future of our, you know, or human race, you know, our planet, right? Maybe those things are meant to be sort of recycled in some sort of way to create, to distill whatever that essence is in our consciousness that drips down into the cosmic, you know, eternity to become something more enlightened in that state. I don't know. You know, I'd like to believe that we have an opportunity here on this world to find, I don't know, an elevated sense of oneself and community, and that there is sort of a cosmic hand that's almost waiting to embrace us on that fact. I hope that's the case, because with that, it enables us as humanity to strive for something much better. Right. And so I think that's the best thing to think about in those terms. But who's to say that conversely, that hand on the wheel is hoping that we suffer, and everything we're doing right now is just in contrast to that, that we're fighting against that system to find that beauty and wonder here in this place, to create heaven on earth, essentially, before we even get the opportunity to go up there or something, you know?
So what you're saying is the great creator is a credit card company. They want you accruing debt and interest and paying off your balances. Come on, think about it. Here's another offer.
Right.
That is interesting to think of it in that way. I mean, because I guess maybe it is I don't know, very optimistic just to assume that the quote unquote creator or creation of this whole thing has been to get to, you know, enlightenment as opposed to the opposite. I mean, it feels like, you know, it could be either one. I mean, there's no reason one has to be quote unquote better than the other. When you talk about it, it makes me think about like life in general and what we're doing, right? And it strikes me that it's the difference between a bunch of kids getting together to like throw the ball around just for fun, opposed to a bunch of kids getting together to play an organized game that has a final outcome.
Mm.
Right? And both of them can be very enjoyable, I suppose. But maybe just getting together to throw the ball around for an indefinite amount of time with no scorekeeping, no winner or loser, it's much better because it's not finite, right?
Hmm.
There's no innings limit or a score that once you reach, game's over. I feel like we're definitely playing the organized game right now.
Mm-hmm.
As a species.
Mm. Mm. Yeah. And, you know, Daniel's been talking a lot about chaos lately.
Yeah.
And I think like using that as a lens to look at some of this through is really important, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, you just set the table for me to talk about humor, you know, which I mentioned at the top of that. I don't remember if you were recording or not, but something that has been on my mind a lot lately is how hilariously rigid we are, and how, you know, when you step outside of that and you know, look, if we can look at ourselves from an outside perspective, the rigidity is just ridiculously funny. You know, all these rules that we require and that we set up for ourselves and I guess, you know, lately what I've really been vibing is this tension between order and chaos. And we think of order as being somehow more virtuous, but there's something there's an incredible power in being sloppy. You know, it's like you think about some of our favorite artists, Marlon Brando, you know, it's just a fucking mess, you know, we can't take our eyes off of him. And, you know, one of the things I mentioned in that email I sent you guys was this idea that, that jazz and like cosmic jazz, which a lot of people go, Jesus, that's not music. Well, that maybe that's actually closest to the music of existence, and that the very structured music that we tend to favor, those of us who are less adventurous listeners, is like a joke. It's ridiculous. And if you think about, you know, I've been talking about Jerry Lewis with you guys, who, you know, I was very close with and learned so much from and continue to learn from even after he has died. But there was a photo that came up on Twitter on President's Day or whatever was the holiday. I don't know if it was President's Day or Washington's birthday or something, but it was a photo of Jerry in the Oval Office with the Reagans. And there, you know, and this is, you know, the most respectable seat of power in the world, this room, and they're supposed to be posing in a very official way for the White House photographer, and Jerry was making a funny face to the camera, right? Like in the Oval Office, this is not acceptable behavior, right? But and, you know, when you think about some of his most memorable sequences in his films, is like my favorite is The Ladies' Man, where the gangster comes in to pick up his girlfriend and Jerry starts taking his hat apart, just literally thread by thread. He's pulling the guy's head apart, and this man who walked in extremely structured with his clean suit and his sharp lines, he leaves in chaos, is sweating and his hair is messed up, and you know, Jerry won that bout, right? Like chaos won, silliness won, and which a lot of which dovetails back to you, Ryan, like, you know, this funny confluence for you of comedy and a very serious study of the esoteric, which, you know, we've talked about, like, how do those things go together? You know, it, for me, as someone, I mean, all three of us came from other fields and into the study or an interest in the esoteric. You know, at least I came out of, I was making horror movies when this started for me. There's some, there, you know, there's some like inherent logic to it. Like you came from comedy, which, in, you know, at first blush, I would think, you know, no, that's not related. No, it is for sure related, because you're, as a comedian, you're a trickster, right? Like the one of the fundamentals of comedy is a sudden burst of chaotic energy or you know, a chaotic logic into some, that upsets a structure, a structural conceit. God, this sounds so academic. the other thing I want to say is about a couple things about you, to respond to what you were saying, Jim. I think I have a far more nihilistic view than you. That, you know, you're saying, like, you know, is our job here to, I forget exactly how you put it, but to sort of, you know, luxuriate in the beauty of the cosmos or what have you. And, you know, and are we on the road to graduating? And so, you know, I think what I would say is, first of all, I don't think we're even remotely important. I think we're like bacteria in, you know, that's like our stature in the grand scheme of life and reality. And like what, how we fare is just, it's a passingly interesting little blip of data for some higher being. Do you remember the humans in the Earth reality? Like, yeah, whatever happened to them? Totally imploded. Yeah. Oh, that's a shame. Anyway, back to business. I don't know that we're even merit a footnote in the book. We could have, but you know, I remember when I was in New York for September 11th, and which was just, it's impossible not to experience that event and not do some incredible soul searching about good and evil and humanity and order and chaos. And I remember kind of walking away from that thinking that, and this is so basic, but that however many years it took to build the World Trade Center, I don't know the answer, I guess is about 10 at least, a minimum, that it took just mere moments to destroy it. And this incredible imbalance that exists in that respect, that it takes so long to create and it's so easy to destroy, right? Yeah. Like who made that rule? That doesn't seem fair.
Yeah. Wow.
And yet we primarily create. Like, I walked away from that feeling good about humanity, that look, if it's that easy to destroy and that hard to create and we're mostly creating, doesn't that bode well for us? I'm sorry to say, in the era of Trump, and if anyone's a Trump voter and they're offended by this, fuck you, good. it shouldn't even be a contest. It shouldn't be a contest. The fact that anyone voted for that beacon of evil, let alone approximately half of the United States population, we're fucked. We're fucked. It's like the distance that we would have to travel. We talk about enlightenment as though it's this amazing, unattainable thing. It shouldn't be. If the experiment had gone correctly, we would have achieved enlightenment quickly, right away. And after all these years, the allure of evil is so powerful to so many people that it's still the scale is still sort of balanced. This is why I've come to just think it's over for us. I can't, it's great that I do believe that good, it's like, you know, two steps forward, one step back. Good is more powerful than evil, but only by a little bit. And I don't think that's enough. Yeah, I think it needs to be overwhelmingly more present than evil, like 99% to 1%, not 51 to 49.
Right,
And this is why I don't think, like, you know, the comet's going to strike the Earth in the next 10 years. But it's, you know, so what where does that leave us? I think this is where I would inject a little bit of positivity. This is what I was saying in the email to you guys too, is that, you know, for those of us that are fighting for progress and awareness, there is still a point. And, but I think at this juncture, the point is exit strategy more than anything. You know, we should still fight for spiritual awakening and progress, but not to save humanity so much, because I don't think it's possible. But it's more, the purpose of it now is, you know, when this experiment does come to an end, to your question, what happens to consciousness? It does continue. You know, hopefully we'll be a little bit prepared for the chaotic reality that awaits us outside of this sort of, you know, the false construct that we live inside in our brain. The universe is in our brains. I should give inspirational talks.
or podcasting, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh yeah, that's what that is.
Hey, it's Jim Perry, host of Euphemet, a podcast about the unknown and our relationship to it. And I wanted to let you know that we begin a new season on Thursday, March 11th. New episodes every other week featuring real people sharing stories on how anomalous experiences have shaped their life. We can't wait to return on March 11th, but for now, please enjoy this sneak preview of an upcoming episode and keep looking up.
I always knew like things were different around me. When we started house shopping, that's when it started coming out the most. Still remember one of the first houses that we looked at. Pulled up, chain link fence in the front, nice, beautiful green grass. And I was in the back seat with my mom and my sister. And I look at the house and the first thing I see is on one of the walls, sitting in the chair so she would be facing the floor, is an old lady. So she was not on the ground. She was, her chair was on the wall when I saw her, kind of looking over and smiling, but it was the ugliest, most putrid smile ever. And that's the image that I got. It's not like I'm seeing you. It's almost like a quick, like a boom, like a flash, like bam, there's an image. And I was a little kid, you know? And as soon as that image hit me, I grabbed onto my mom. And my mom, she was always very in tune with me. She said, you know, what's the matter? And I said, hey, look, there's no lady in this house. I just saw her. She's in there. She's not nice. She's in that back room right there. I'm like, mom, I don't want to go in this house. And I started freaking out, started panicking. I thank God for my mom, because she said to my dad, she's like, hey, we're not going in this house. And he's like, well, why not? She's like, no, you know what? I don't really like it. And she made something up. And she told him later, you know, what I had told her. And my father was very, oh man, he's old school and a drinker back then. And unfortunately, he was physically abusive towards me back then. And, you know, he went the typical, he needs to stop being such a pussy and blah, blah, blah. And right away, I was like, this is strange. This isn't right. Like, why is this happening to me? We fast forward, my dad's talking to my mom and he's got this look like disbelief. He's just like, what? Are you sure? Are you positive? And being the nosy little kid that I was, you know, I walk in and he walks away from my mom and I'm like, what's wrong with dad? You know, what's his deal? And Vera, the lady that was the realtor, told him that yes, there was an elderly woman that lived there and she passed away in the house. She passed away in one of the back rooms. And I right away was like, I knew it, you know? I was like, oh, I told you, you know? I had a victory, you know? It wasn't a good one, but I was just like, oh, yes. Fuck him. You know, I hope he's terrified. And he looked terrified, this man. He just looked like, I can't believe this shit, you know? Because my dad is very like, if I don't see it, I'm not going to believe it. You know, if it doesn't happen, if I didn't see it, it didn't happen. And I'm like, that's an awful way to think.
On March 11th, we begin again. The critically acclaimed podcast Euphemet returns. Hear it on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts.
I think what strikes me most about what you've just said is at the heart of it, it seems like the brain as an untrustworthy instrument is at the heart of this. In one aspect, as far as the filtering of and the creating of a reality and in what you believe a reality is, right? And because I don't think it's that far-fetched to say that there are at least some people who were the Trump voters who thought that it was like their reality happened to be he's trying to save us, right? As opposed to, you know, leaning into being like, isn't it fun to be the bad guy? Even though I do think a large percentage of them loved that. And, you know, whether they wanted to admit it or not, I mean, I heard people say, oh, I love how he just says whatever he wants, you know, and like, oh, that's so you civility is gone now. But there, I think there was a small percentage of people who bought into the QAnon stuff, who thought that he was trying to take down an evil cabal of cannibalistic, you know, pedophile, like all that shit. And it's the brain, right? It's the brain that these people have that is untrustworthy in so many. We can be affected in so many ways from outside forces that shape the way we think and the way we believe. But I don't know. Maybe it's naive of me, but I do believe at the end of the day, when you're laying in bed or lying in bed, whatever one it is, and you're getting ready to go to sleep, and you're I mean, I don't know if anyone else does this, but I mean, every single night I'm confronting who I am right before I fall asleep. It's maybe a little jarring, but you have those moments where you're like, okay, I know what's real, right? You know what's really, you know the truth. Like, whether or not it's intellectual or like a feeling in your heart, the feeling in my heart isn't great when I think about the future of humanity, especially after watching Life on Our Planet, the Attenborough documentary. About climate change and all this other kind of stuff. It's just like, yeah, we're fucked. I mean, it's people only care about making money and they don't give a shit. And people love evil. You know, good isn't that much more powerful. Like you said, I believe that. And it's losing in many ways. People will put aside good if it serves them, you know, I mean, I think at the end of the day, it's a selfishness issue, right? Potentially. And in this Death of Forever book, he's talking about like the biological imperative and how the idea of a organism is to, you know, reproduce itself at such a high level that it becomes impervious to, I guess, extinction, right? Regardless of environmental concerns.
Yeah.
Because if human beings make 15 billion of us, it doesn't matter what volcano goes off. You know, the chances are there's, you know, the more of us there are, the higher chance there is that at least a couple of us will survive.
Yeah.
Regardless of what we do to ourselves, right? So it's like this weird paradox of like, well, the population exploding is creating a strain on the environment. Yeah. The more of us there are, the better chance we have to survive the strain on the environment we're causing. I mean, I don't know the answer, obviously, but I do think it's interesting that at the same time all this is happening, we are entering at least an era of more people like awakening to the strange, right? I wonder what correlation there is to the two things and what your thoughts are on that.
I got nothing, Jim.
You got nothing, Jim. What about you?
I wonder about it. This is all new to me. I'm entering this world only in the last year or so, and I hear from those of you who've been in it longer that there are a lot of people like me who are coming newly to this awareness. So I don't know. I don't know if I understand it.
Well, I wonder if it's a fracturing, right? And when anything fractures, you know, something seeps in, right? And, or air gets in or water gets out or whatever it is, whichever way you want to view it. And when things break open, and maybe it's that chaos, right? Being introduced. You know, the more people that are aware of something or interested in something, the more opportunity for chaos to play, to increase, and which brings different perspectives, you know, points of view, and also new information, right? And what's that? I can't remember the phenomena. It's like the scientific experiment about the rats that was happening in one place in the world where they were training the rats in a certain way. And then once they reached like a tipping point, a certain number of the rats that were doing it, the rats in a different part of the world started doing the same thing.
Right. Yeah.
It's like the non-locality.
They wouldn't eat the poison. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's like, at what point, I mean, I wonder, I mean, are we potentially headed towards that same point, right? Where enough people have had experiences of the paranormal nature, or the esoteric, or the unexplainable, to where it becomes, oh, like it now becomes like part of everybody.
Yeah. I mean, it's possible, right, in some context, that there's just going to be a broader interest in these things as personal experiences. And folks being willing, because of softening and sort of media constructs and within their inner circle, within their relationships, people just being more accepting of having these type of conversations. You know, you saw a UFO, your buddy's not going to call you a freak. He's going to go, oh, was it a triangle? I saw one of those on TV the other day. So I think culturally we're at a place where we've experienced decades and decades and decades of this stuff as formal entertainment. Oh, we can't, you know, and the biggest movies in Hollywood, the biggest podcast, you know, all these things, like they integrate ideas and narrative from the supernatural. And because we live in a space now where, especially with Gen Z, but it extends even further, a participatory audience, folks want to go and they want to have these experiences themselves. And you even see it sort of with popular culture. You know, a celebrity will talk about having one experience and then will be placed right into the deep of it. You know, look at that rapper that was just photographed at Skinwalker Ranch because he had a passing interest in UFOs and stated.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Post Malone. So, you know, I think that's part of it. But I think what we're seeing is a reaction to Trump era chaos magic. Now, we can talk about all the benefits of chaos, but when you talk about chaos, the management of that and the manifestation of chaos through something like chaos magic, that's what Trump and all of the cronies were doing. And so, but with that, you know, there's a great responsibility, and there's always consequences for using magic. It's a push and a pull. There's a give and receive. And I think a large amount of folks coming into the paranormal space and becoming participant is because of participant culture, because of the deconstruction of media, the fracturing of narrative. And in response to Trump really aggressively shattering, creating a mass shattering for so many people who thought they knew what everyday life once was. And if you're someone who is paying attention to politics or Western culture, this was a fucking shattering. And we weren't ready for it. And we weren't ready to look across to our neighbor and go like, what the fuck? Like, what reality are you in? And we don't like having those feelings. So we need to find something else that it either grounds us and or sinks us deeper into a rabbit hole where we feel like we can find some personal meaning in something. So I know that my personal engagement, even with this topic, has escalated dramatically post-Trump, because it did leave me with, you know, a wonder about like how we can live every day in the paranormal. And listen, we're talking here as like three white dudes. You know, if you ask one of our people of color friends, they might say that, you know, Daniel, we know someone, right? That they're like, being black is paranormal.
Yeah, yeah.
Every day.
A living horror movie. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think more people were awakened to those possibilities.
Yeah.
Their reality mirroring those things that they see in pop culture, in movies, in entertainment. you know, this idea of a emerging techno dystopia, the fall, like all of these things that we're talking about in terms of the classification, the fall of our culture or our humanity, people are seeing that and going like, shit, if that's possible, what else is possible? UFOs, Sasquatch. You know what? Instead of watching CNN today, I think I'm going to go use Randonautica and maybe stumble across a Sasquatch. But I think that's what people are seeing. Now, what's going to be amazing, though, is if this legion of folks that are now being titillated by the field in a new way evolve from that, like folks like Daniel, and start collecting all these books and diving deep into research and finding a foundation and beliefs and systems of beliefs and deconstructing constructs set up within society's bounds, then we're going to actually see a change in the physical space based on the influences of those people being inspired by what else could be out there. We're going to see it in technology, and we're already seeing it. We can talk shit about Clubhouse, or I can talk shit about Clubhouse and my experience on there. But if you go into some of those rooms, there's some of the smartest people you may, if you're going to meet them in person, maybe the smartest person you've ever met in your life. And they're talking about quantum technology and non-human intelligence at length for hours together, the smartest people in the room. So these are people who were inspired to sort of change their trajectory, to change their focus, to integrate what we know about reality, technology, culture, and then imbue them with different ways from a different standpoint. So Trump fucked up, because what he did was he unleashed a legion of people who are now thinking about the world in different ways and are going to start bringing that, integrating that back into their normal lives. I'm really confident in that.
Wow, it's interesting to think of it as a catalyst. I mean, or him as a catalyst, or, you know, the movement or the whatever, what the, you know, things behind, the forces behind him. I do think it touches on something very interesting. And Jim, you and I briefly spoke about this, you know, casually, was, I think it was Greg Bishop in the On the Trail of series for UFOs with Shannon LeGros. And where I think it was Greg who was saying, I think people are missing the point when they're talking about like what technology, what's the technology behind the UFOs and these things. It's what's the experience, what's the change on a personal level that this experience has had for the individual? Isn't that more important than, you know, the what wires were connected where and what kind of propulsion system did the thing have? And I think that's probably one of the most fascinating aspects of, because I mean, it rings of what my therapist, when I first started going to see a PTSD therapist for my experience in Florida, he said to me, I'm not concerned with what it was. I'm concerned with the effect it had on you. That's what's important here. And it wasn't until recently that I realized, oh, this is the, he just said the exact same thing that, you know, and it's what I'm going through. And I was in Sedona a week and a half ago for a couple nights. And, you know, there was a strange experience of the smallest nature that sent me spiraling. And, you know, nearly 2 years after my experience, where I thought I was like kind of in the clear now. And turns out that I wasn't.
Oh, wow.
But so like, what's the effect it has on, you know, in my experience, I don't know, you know, this isn't a game of like whose was more intense or whatever, but when you have people talking about being abducted by, you know, aliens, extraterrestrials, imagine integrating that into normal life. Right. You know, and I'm guilty of it. Like, well, who were they? Where did they take you? As opposed to, okay, what's the effect this has had on a personal level of the individual?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. It's we're obsessed with outer space, but we should be obsessed with inner space. When the film came back of the rover on Mars, I watched it with eagerness, and it's so boring because who gives a shit what's up there on that rock? It has nothing to do with anything. Like all this effort that we're exerting into like getting up onto these other stones that are floating around up there. There's like, I'd rather look in the ocean where there's actual life, you know? And was fucking around with my cats with the laser pointer. And, you know, and it's like, that's like a UFO to them. They're like, what is this? Like, get, you know, but meanwhile, we're just kind of up here, like screwing with them, like Chuck laughing at how silly they are. That's us. Like the, you know, that's like UFO, Sasquatch, ghosts. I don't think any of it is even remotely important, but it's all we have and we're obsessed with it. But we're just all looking in totally the wrong places about everything. I mean, I'm glad that we're paying attention a little bit, but what is the meaning of UFOs? To your point, Ryan, you know, that you're I'm just reiterating what you're saying. I'm mansplaining you that you hear a UFO story and what is it? Where did it come from? How does it work? What wire plugs into what? It's not important. It's like, it's like the laser pointer, you know, it's like the real question is like, what is reality? It's all the questions that you're asking in this conversation. And probably some of the most evolved people who have ever lived are people we may not even know their names. You know, they were people who achieved transcendence through meditation, or maybe they're just, their brains were wired, quote unquote, incorrectly. The most evolved person in the world may be in an institution right now, you know, like in solitary confinement somewhere, because they're so, their experience of reality is so chaotic that they're locked up. Yeah. But they're not inside, they're free in their mind, you know, or whatever you want to call it in the consciousness. And the other thing that I was remembering, I wanted to respond to about your talk about the brain is that and the idea, Jim, that you introduced that consciousness may or may not even live in the brain, is, I think it's really interesting to contemplate what we're now just starting to understand, that, you know, I'm a person who, I deal with depression and I also have stomach issues, and they always happen at the same time. And so it's, you know, and I've been learning a little bit about how they're like, the stomach has a sort of a nervous system or like an emotional chemistry in it I assume it interacts with the brain. I don't know enough about this, but you know, that our feelings are in our bellies, you know, and so like there's some other command center there, and our genitals are incredibly powerful forces, you know, and but let's be real about it. They are, you know, like, you know, there's, you know, it's, we have a lot of organs in our body that are pulling the strings for us, for, you know, for whatever the self is. It's not just the brain, it's all, you know, it's the whole construct of the body. And sometimes I think getting out of your brain is the ultimate goal, you know, or getting out of all of it, really. So I'm going to kill myself today, guys. That's the answer. I'm so relentlessly dark today. I don't know. I'm in a good mood, weirdly. I don't know.
No, it's. I mean, I think we're allowed to be all those things simultaneously. But you know something. Well, something that's interesting to me that I just learned, like casually and without even seeking it out, was that speaks to this point of moving from looking outward to inward.
Yeah.
I think sometimes there's good signposts to see, like, oh, okay, maybe this is happening. I think we mentioned Skinwalker Ranch. I didn't know Post Malone was out there. That's interesting. That's, I guess it's funny. The Robert Bigelow used to own Skinwalker Ranch, the billionaire who's got his own little space company. Well, it turns out, he no longer owns Skinwalker Ranch, but Robert Bigelow, I guess not that long ago, he diverted his money and his research into consciousness, which I just learned. Mm-hmm. And I think that speaks directly to what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, I have always been somewhat fascinated by this guy. I mean, he's got all the money that you could want to throw at, like, trying to figure things out, right? And he was obsessed with Skinwalker Ranch, one might argue, to buy the place in the first place. And then now it's consciousness,
yeah,
that he's working on. And which points to Dr. Stephen Greer, who's been, he's been talking about consciousness the whole time. And so I feel like it's going there. I feel like that's where all of this is headed, in my opinion, that whether it's, you know, and if the brain creates our reality, right, and is an untrustworthy instrument, everything is real and unreal. Our brain therefore creates Sasquatch, creates UFOs, creates all these things, like, but it's a shared reality, right, with other people. And it all kind of points back to consciousness, right? And it's, I'm wondering what, I don't even really know what the world looks like when everybody's just dives in headfirst into that. I'm curious what you think might be, you know, happening in that situation. Like, I don't think it's even occurred to me to think about it. Like, when everybody just goes all in on consciousness is reality, and everybody just says, we get to shape it, you know, like, what does that even, I mean, does everyone just kind of fracture off into like a parallel dimension? Or is there still a co-authoring happening?
Wow.
Do you want to take that, Daniel?
I think when that happens, what the result will be that every single need that we have will be instantaneously satisfied with an Amazon delivery. No, I really don't. I don't know. That's a beautiful question. I have no idea what. I mean, that, you know, that's the question. That I think what you're asking is sort of the same thing that the drum I've been beating in this very nihilistic conversation that we're having is the answer to that is, you know, what our destination was meant to be, or maybe what it is. It's yeah. If you take so I was talking, my daughter the other day was, you know, as I've talked on your podcast, Jim, about how my daughter is sensitive like I am, and how I realized that when she would talk about sort of esoteric experiences, I would sort of dissuade her and shame her because I didn't feel equipped to have the conversations, and how I've been working on that. So, you know, I little by little sort of let her into my stuff. And the other night she asked me what I thought a ghost was. And I was like, okay, I gotta make sure I answer this very, very thoughtfully. So what I said was, I said, well, I'm sitting here in your room with you next to your bed while you're getting ready to go to sleep. And right here, there's your nightstand is sitting next to you. Right. And she said, yeah. And I said, how do you know that the nightstand is here? And she was like, well, you know, she knocked on it. And I was like, cause you can hear it. And she was like, yeah. And I can feel it. And I was like, right. Okay. And you can see it. Right. And you can taste it. If you licked it, don't do that. But, you know, we ran through all five of the senses. And I said, these are five ways that you can prove to yourself that this nightstand is next to your bed. She said, yes. And I said, okay, where are those sensory experiences? She said, what do you mean? And I said, where are they actually happening? And she said, in my brain? And I said, that's right. So if the table that you're interpreting is only present in your brain, can you say for sure that it's really here? Right. And she was like, oh boy. And I said, no. She said, let me tell you what this has to do with ghosts. And she said, okay. And I said, what if there's more than five senses? What if there's like an infinite number of senses? And there's in this very spot that you and I are sitting, there's another father and daughter having the same conversation, but they have a different five senses from us. We can't conceive of what their five senses are, and they can't conceive of what our five senses are. And because of that, we don't know that the other set of father and daughter is there, just as they don't know that we're here, even though we're sitting in exactly the same spot. Well, my belief is that a ghost is when, for some reason, there's a little overlap in those sensory systems, and you might be somebody else's ghost in their construct of senses, just as they're your ghost in your five senses and the organization that they present into your brain. And she said, I don't want to talk about this anymore.
My father just convinced me I'm a ghost. How do I go on from there? It's like one of those things like, you know, first day of school, tell us something interesting about yourself. Well, I am a ghost.
My dad says,
yeah. And you cannot prove me wrong, by the way, obviously, because here's some logic I will lay out for you.
Oh man.
That is interesting. And what's, what really sticks out to me, is I think one of the things that's at the heart of a lot of this is our need to prove something, right? Mm-hmm. And like, how do you prove that that table is real? How do you, you know, prove that ghosts are real? How do I prove that this experience is valid,
yeah,
or actually happening? And maybe it's the release of the need for approval and proving that is maybe that's the real freedom.
So that's something, yeah, I've talked to both of you guys about with that stairs analogy of you know, if you know, the basic scientific principle is that it's a series of assumptions and you prove one at a time, and if you can't prove one, you don't proceed, right? So if that's a set of stairs, you're never going to get to the top of the stairs, which if you did, you might look down and see a reality that you couldn't see from the bottom of the stairs. So when you let go of the burden of proof and actually operate on, funnily enough, faith, is when I think actually you can see things and experience things that scientific method prevents you from seeing. Because it's so unbelievably limiting. And this idea of proof, I mean, maybe this is another gift that Trump has given us, is that we don't trust, no one trusts facts anymore. Like, we debate what a fact even is, right? and you know, I mean, we're also married to our belief systems. People who don't want to believe in the paranormal, there's no amount of proof that you can show them that's going to change their mind. I've shown both of you like photos I have on my phone of what are they, ghosts? I mean, I showed you one, Ryan, in that parking lot. You almost collapsed on the floor, you know. I've shown those same pictures to skeptics, and they're like, oh, it was doctored. It was like, well, it wasn't actually. It was this came directly out of the camera. You know, I took the picture. You know, well, there's a laser, they had a hologram. It's like, proof doesn't matter. It doesn't change anybody's mind about anything, really. Yeah. I mean, I know it does in scientific communities, but that's my point, is that scientific communities are, I mean, it's clear, clearly our scientific method isn't working, because it doesn't account for such a vast amount of information that people like us, who for whatever reason have those, as John Keel describes, those brains that have a little bit more reception, which is apparently a huge swath of the human population, but science denies it. So clearly science isn't working. The scientific method is not functioning properly.
And I wish I could remember I wish I could remember the phrase, but there's also a phenomenon about the decay of, something being proven as real or as true. And over time, I really wish I could remember this, but it will start to become untrue.
Wow.
I think we get so fixated on wanting reality to be fixated or fixed.
Fixed, yeah.
That we, you know, it speaks to that rigidity that we talked about at the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Jim, I'm curious, when it comes to breaking free of the rigidity and allowing ourselves not to be so fixed, like in your personal experience, you know, do you find that there has been any like instances where maybe you became aware like, oh, I've been too fixated or I've been too fixed on this specific thing inside the field of, you know, what is unknown that you've even had to move away from, or if there's ever been, you know, as opposed to like the skeptic moving away from being skeptic, is there anything that you have found yourself having to be, I guess, I don't know if nebulous is the word, but being more, you know, you had to be more fluid about.
Mm. Well, I think the challenge for me is actually imparting that idea to others and finding a place in myself where I don't have to beat myself down if they don't agree with me. So, for example, you know, the construct of Euphemet is, you know, it provides no proof, right? It provides anecdotal proof, right? Which I feel is very important. Anecdotal evidence, these narratives, these stories of people experiencing things that they feel that happened to them and have transformed their lives in some ways. That's all I need for something like that. And I think doing the show in that way has provided me a lens to view the rest of the phenomenon through, in that I do appreciate things like UFO nuts and bolts. Did they find debris? But I almost appreciate that in a more entertainment way than, you know, right? Like contributing to my overall belief system or my notions of what it's going to take to convince me that something else is going on. I don't give a shit about any of that, really. But I do see how for some that, you know, maybe that is their bag. Maybe their bag is, listen, I've got an engineering background. That's how my mind works. I'm really interested in UFOs, but it's because I want to understand this technology that may be out there, right? And so for me, it's my challenge has been to recognize and understand that folks are different. They're going to come at this stuff from different angles. And I think it has to be fine. Like it has to be okay that there's others that, you know, Sasquatch, flesh and blood, he's real out in the forest. I'm going to, you know, find him and take a leg back or something. Like you may not convince that person that Sasquatch is maybe an ultra terrestrial, right? Or the ghost of some other past. Like you may not get that through to that person, but it has to be okay that individuals are bringing their own perspective to this space, I guess. And it is a little hard for me because I want more people to just jump into this boat where it's like, hey, we're trying to figure something out, knowing that we probably will never know, but it's okay because we're experiencing things and there's narrative here and it's juicy and there's stakes and emotions. And, you know, that's what compels me to this stuff. And so it's, you know, if others don't want to, if they're not intrigued or motivated in this space in that way, completely fine, nothing wrong with it, right? But it, you know, I do have to just be fine with that, I guess.
Throwing the paranormal ball around.
There it is.
As opposed to, let's play this paranormal game where the outcome is you will believe.
Yeah.
Or I lose.
Well, listen, there's also a construct that I think all of us have encountered in which when you're a content creator, you know, when you're a producer, when you're a creator, and you're essentially trying to convince stakeholders to engage in something, you know, sometimes it's like, hey, where's the evidence for this stuff? You know, and I understand that too sometimes, because for a majority, for maybe a majority of the audience, those that are sitting in their front room and, hey, here's my nightstand, I'm not even thinking about it in any sort of sensory way at all, they can see something that is typically considered more physical evidence and go like, yep, that's it. That proves it. You know what I mean? Or at least convince them in some way. But, you know, the stuff we're talking about today, especially like sort of science, right? Like Daniel was saying, like science is seemingly like the scientific method in its state now, you know, sort of Newtonian science, thank you, Francis Bacon, has its end somewhere. Like it is not. And the thing to consider is that when you start looking at other forms of science, like quantum science, there are things that are true about quantum science that works within that structure that doesn't work within other sciences and vice versa. So we're now in a space where even scientists are going like, well, you know, that's going to work if we consider it this way, but it's not going to work if we consider it this way. And so is it because both are true? Is it because both are false? Right? Like, yeah, I don't know. I think we were talking about that maybe a little bit last time, this idea that, you know, there is an opposing and also partnering forces of the nature of reality. And it's not all just in science, and multiple things can be true and false at the same time, it appears.
Yeah. And it almost strikes me as, you know, there's the perspective that science, a part of science is like, you know, like a cable package. If it doesn't have every channel, it's bullshit. Okay. I need every channel, man. And it's like, no, I mean, you can still have, there's still way too much that you'll never be able to watch.
That's right. By the way, there's still nothing to watch.
Yes, that's exactly.
99 channels of nothing.
Yes, that's exactly how that should have ended. Well, this has been fun. I think we're gonna call it here. I mean, I do really want to talk about Muse and Genius and stuff, but maybe sometime in the future. This was a lot of fun. We'll do another one. You know, I think we're gonna, you know, maybe, you know, save that for some future stuff. You know, if I can convince the two of you to watch the Liz Gilbert TED Talk at some point,
sure.
Before we talk about Genius and things like that, because I do think the trickster is a huge element in that as well.
Yep.
So that could be pretty fascinating. Jim, do you want to remind people about Euphemet and like what's going on with Night Drift and where they can find all this all this great content you're putting out?
Yeah, you can find everything that I'm doing at euphemet.com. That's euphomet. We're actually starting a new season on Thursday, March 11th, with new episodes every other week. Very excited about that, to have a full Euphemet season. Conversely, you can go over to Patreon and you can engage with us in live conversations, sometimes with Ryan. We need to pull Daniel over for a Night Drift as well for some conversations. And what's that?
Depress everyone. Yeah.
Why did I lose 50% of my patrons? What's going on here?
Welcome to Night Drift Dark Mode. We've got Daniel Loa here.
And that's it. And just follow me on social at Euphemet.
And Jim wanted me to make sure that I really plug that you find him on Clubhouse. Find Jim on Clubhouse. and Daniel, I did watch. I haven't filled out the notes sheet yet, but I recently watched Arch Enemy, which is available.
So good.
Such a good movie. If you're into the idea of, you know, parallel dimensions, visitors from parallel dimensions, what these things mean, like what translates from, you know, like, let's say hypothetically a being, you know, travels from one dimension to another, what will translate about that person's physical abilities and just who they are from one dimension to another. You got to check that movie out. It's pretty, pretty rad. That's the latest and greatest, right? That you've put out.
Yeah. Arch Enemies. Yeah. The most recent film, but yeah, I mean, I guess having without realizing it, made a few films about these esoteric topic, I would point people toward Color Out of Space with Nicolas Cage, which is very much about interdimensional terror, you know, Mandy, and Daniel Isn't Real is the same filmmaker who made Arch Enemy, is also about an interdimensional character. It's clearly a subject that's been on our minds over at Spectre Vision, my company.
And about the Arch Enemy soundtrack? Oof.
Yeah, man.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Check that out on Spotify.
By Umberto. Yeah. And the vinyl's coming out in, I guess, about a couple of months. It's the vinyl's a completely different record from the digital release, which is, it's going to be also fantastic.
Oh, so wow. Good. That's rad. That's really cool. Okay. Well, guys, this has been great. Thanks for doing it. Thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye,
everybody. Happy to be in the triangle table.
Yeah. Well, oh, yeah. Yeah. So that concludes this episode of the triangle table. One, one point of darkness, one point of light, and one point of what? Of ingenue. sponsored by Folgers Coffee and an adorable cat that was making a cameo. This has been great. And we'll talk again soon.
Love you guys.
Bye, guys.